The great temptation in our culture, and it's probably true of essentially every other culture, both past and present on the face of the earth, is to be concerned overly much about what other people think about us. God has made us to be very gregarious people. That is, we like to be with other people. It's the rare person who wants to live out in the desert or out in the woods all by themselves and never have contact with other people. That's why the overwhelming number of people in our country and other countries around the world live in cities. It's not just because of the convenience of work or school and shopping, but because we like to be around other people. But joined with us being around other people is the influence of what other people do and what other people think about us. We're very much people who tend to be conformist. I mean, I didn't see anyone here this morning wearing a kilt. I didn't see anyone here wearing a loincloth. I didn't see anyone here wearing a robe like an Arabic person in Saudi Arabia would wear, because we want to dress pretty much like everybody else. Now, there are limits. We don't want to all wear exactly the same color and the same outfit to that extent, but we conform, and that's what we want to do. And we want other people to accept both who we are and what we do, the way we dress, the way we live. And so in doing that, we tend to live like other people live. We all live in houses or apartments. We don't live in a tent. We spend a great deal of money. We'd spend a lot less money if we did live in tents. But we live in houses and do the same kind of things, drive cars and all sorts of things like other people do. Yes, there's a great element of convenience and comfort in that, but it also is a matter of conformity. And we're very sensitive to the criticism of other people if we are nonconformist. If something about what we do or say or the way we live or the way we look even isn't up to what other people think is praiseworthy, then we're very sensitive about that. What's true in our daily life and what's true in the culture in which we live often ends up being true in religion as well. Many people are greatly influenced in their religion by what other people think about them. And so that influences very much things like where they go to church, who they go to church with, what church they go to, what doctrines they espouse, and what doctrines they won't espouse. They're very much influenced by being seen by others. They often will see going to church, and I realize this may be decreasing in our country as fewer and fewer people go to church, but they often go to church because it's good for business. It's a time for networking. That's the word they use this day and time. They're often going to church at the same place that many of the people that they do business with go to church, or where their schoolmates of their children go to church, and where people in their neighborhood go to church. Some people see going to church or being religious as a means for status in the community. If most people in the community go to church, they go to church. If most people in the community don't go to church, then they're less likely to go to church. And they want to be seen. They want to be known as people who conform in that way. The same was true in Jesus' day. And sadly, just like today, for many people, in Jesus' day, being seen and being seen being religious seemed to actually become more important to them than having a real relationship with God was. Now, they just sort of assumed they had that relationship with God. But that what they were really concerned about was what other people thought about them. And that's so often true today with people as well. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, is drawing a sharp contrast between the doctrines and practices of these people led by the Pharisees and teachers of the law and those who would choose to follow Him. And He called those who followed the practices of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law a not very nice word in our culture today, hypocrites. And in truth, it wasn't a very nice word in their day either. Because hypocrite meant playing a part, acting as if you're something you are really not. And that's what had happened in much of their religion. We've seen over the last couple of weeks in chapter 6 of Matthew, in this part of the Sermon on the Mount, that in areas having to do with their generosity and giving to the needy, as well as in their area of praying, they had become very concerned about what other people thought about them. So they gave to help the needy so others could see them doing it. Whether it was the needy themselves or their peers who were wealthy like many of them were. And so they would be thought to be one of the group, just like everybody else. The same is true when they prayed. They had a practice of gathering to pray 2 or 3 times a day, morning, noon, and evening, in a public way. And they would always seem to make sure, Jesus said, to be near a prominent street corner just when that time came, so they could stop what they were doing and stand there while everybody else, especially strangers in town, was gawking and looking at them. And they would raise their hands to God with their prayer shawl over their head and in a very loud voice offer a prayer to God. And most of these prayers were memorized. They were set to specific times and events, and they didn't have to come from the heart at all because they had memorized them, and so they could say them without even thinking about them. But they were especially concerned that others saw them do it. And there was a third practice they had. There were the 3 big things that were recognized in Jewish religion in New Testament times as being something every devoted Jew did. They were benevolent, they prayed, and they fasted. And so in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 16, Jesus also addresses this practice and the fact that they often did it not out of a sincere desire to have a closer relationship with God, but they did it so other people could see them. They wanted to be known as religious. They wanted to be known as very pious. They wanted to be known as holy men. And this was not entirely limited to the men, but it was mostly focused on the men, for they were the prominent characters in their culture. And so Jesus says concerning them, "When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show men they are fasting. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so that it will not be obvious to men that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you." Now, at the very beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talked about how, back in chapter 5 and in verse 20, that unless those who follow Him's righteousness exceeded the righteousness of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, they would not enter the kingdom of heaven. But after that one mention of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, from that point forward, Jesus used this other term, hypocrites, to describe them. But He wasn't limiting His comments to the Pharisees themselves and the teachers. For you see, these men, not only were the teachers of the law in the Jewish religion, they were also the example setters. And so everyone wanted to do what they did, act like they acted. Therefore, even if you were not a Pharisee, and even if you were not a teacher of the law, and even if you were not incredibly wealthy like some of them were, because they were very successful businessmen and sometimes even had inheritances that went back generations of land and businesses and so forth. But even if you were just a moderately successful small businessman, or maybe you were even just a farmer, you'd been taught not just to listen to what they said, but do what they did. And so when you gave your little bit to help the poor, you made sure everyone saw you do it. And when you prayed at those times that they had appointed for public prayer, you made sure you were where other people could see you. And even in this matter of fasting, which, truth to tell, we know very little about today, they made sure they acted like the Pharisees acted. And Jesus is telling those who are now coming to hear Him in large crowds, You can't act like the Pharisees and teachers of the law, where it's all about being seen by other people. All that you do, if you're going to follow me, must come instead from the heart. And you must be concerned not about whether or not men see you do these things, but whether or not God sees you and is pleased with what you're doing. Let's talk a little bit about fasting, because we know so little about it. You know, if I passed out a sheet of paper to all of us and said, write down everything you know about fasting, most of us would write a very short discourse. Probably about the most many of us know is that fasting means going without food and perhaps drink for a set period of time. And that's true. But let's see how it fit into the Jewish way of religion and so forth. In the Old Testament, in the law that supposedly governed all that they did in their religion, there was actually only one day of fasting commanded each year. In Leviticus chapter 23, in the instructions about keeping the great Day of Atonement, which took place each year on the 10th day of the 7th month. Now their months don't fall like our months, so that wouldn't mean July 10th as it would on our calendar. But it would be their 7th month on about the 10th day, and that actually by our calendar would fall somewhere usually late in August or early in September, as I remember. They would gather together for this Day of Atonement. This was a most unusual day. Many of their celebrations involved many days, several days long, like Passover and Pentecost and Tabernacles and so forth. But the Day of Atonement was just a single day event. And it was the day every year in which they would gather together while the high priest of the people would take a sacrifice of a lamb. And the lamb would be killed, and the blood from that lamb would be caught in a basin. And for that one time in the entire year, the high priest would not only go into the temple and into the holy place, but he would go all the way to the back of that large room and would go around the curtain and into the most holy place. That only happened one time every year, and that was on this day. And there, the blood that had been caught in the basin for his own sins would be splattered or splashed or sprinkled onto the Ark of the Covenant in the day when that was still there. By Jesus' day, it was an empty room, for the Ark of the Covenant had disappeared hundreds of years before, and it no longer was there. But they would still go in there, and the blood would be sprinkled there. And then the priest would come back out, having offered a blood sacrifice for his own sins, then more lambs would be killed, and some of that blood would be caught into a basin, and he would go back behind the curtain that second time, and this time offer the blood for the sins of all the people. While everyone outside is praying and waiting his return, but they began that day with fasting. It was the only day in the year that the law commanded them to fast. That was the one official day of fasting. Later in time, they added more days, not because God commanded it, but out of their devotion to God and because they wanted to remember certain days. We find that by the time they're in captivity and in Babylon, and this morning as we're studying in the book of Jeremiah, we're talking about them getting right up to that point. But once they actually go into captivity in Babylon, they added 4 more days each year in which they would fast. They would fast each year on the day when the siege against Jerusalem began by the Babylonians. And then they would fast on the day whenever Jerusalem fell. And then they would fast again on the day when the city and the temple was set on fire and destroyed by the Babylonians. And then their fourth fast, they would add, would be after the fall of Jerusalem. Many of the people were carried away into captivity, but a small number stayed in the land. And King Nebuchadnezzar appointed a governor over them by the name of Gedaliah, one of their own, who was to oversee them and be their shepherd and to provide some primitive form of government for them. But some outlaws, about the only way we could call them, among the people, actually assassinated Gedaliah. And so they fasted on that day because that just added torture to torment. Because once Gedaliah was killed, then Nebuchadnezzar came back in and says, I can't even trust the few people I left in the land to respect me and what I'm trying to do. And so they had to flee down to Egypt to escape his vengeance upon them. They'd already lost their city, their nation, their temple, and now they even lost the opportunity, the few that were left, to live in the land. And so they fasted these four times each year on top of that one official fast. By the days of Queen Esther, after the captivity was over, they go back home, but many stayed in the land of Babylon, generation after generation. The Medes and the Persians took over from the Babylonians. Eventually, a king arises who's looking for a new queen, and one of the Jewish maidens who still live there in that land rose up to become his queen, Esther. We have the book about her. Well, she was instrumental then in actually saving her people from extermination because of the evil plottings of one of the king's advisors, Haman. From that point forward, the Jews always celebrated that day with fasting as well, for the time that they were rescued from the hand of their enemies. And so they had a lot of days when they fasted, even though only one of them is actually that God had actually commanded. The others were not wrong to do, but they just were not required. By Jesus' day, not only did they celebrate those, but the Pharisees in particular had designated every Monday and Thursday as a fast day. Now, fast for them only lasted from sunrise to sunset. They could eat before sunrise, and they would eat after sunset, but they would only fast unless it was a multi-day fast, and none of these fasts we've just talked about were. But they just would not eat during the daylight hours. But it was not enough just to, out of respect for God, and we'll talk in just a moment about why they would even want to fast in the first place. It wasn't enough for them just to fast before God. They wanted other people to know they were fasting. They wanted it to be obvious to God, but especially obvious to others, that they were fasting and that they were so religious. It's important to realize that fasting itself did not guarantee a right relationship with God. For example, back in the book we've been reading in Jeremiah in our Bible class in the morning, it tells us in Jeremiah chapter 14 in verses 11 and 12, it says, Then the Lord said to me, Do not pray for the well-being of this people. Although they fast, I will not listen to their cry. Though they offer burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Instead, I will destroy them with a sword, famine, and plague. Why would God say that? Well, because even though they were fasting and still making their sacrifices, there was no repentance. They were living in direct disobedience to God. They were worshiping idols in addition to worshiping God. They were abusing their fellow Jews even while claiming before God that they were keeping God's law, which forbade those kind of things. And so God says, just them keeping these public, visible, religious activities is not enough for me to save them. The same had become true in Jesus' day as well. They wanted men to see that they were fasting and be impressed. William Barclay, in his commentary, and I've read it in many others as well, I just happened to pick this one up, points out, as it says in Luke 18, remember when Jesus tells the story of the Pharisee and the publican going up to the temple to pray? The Pharisee and the tax collector? And the Pharisee stands there and he very publicly in front of everybody and he says, I fast twice every week. Because that was their practice. Barclay points out that these days, Monday and Thursday, happened to be the days when most people came in from the outlying communities to the markets they had. They were the days for shopping. And so crowds were larger in Jerusalem on Mondays and Thursdays. And so a lot of people from out of town would be in from the surrounding communities to either buy or to sell and conduct business. And of course, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law would be out doing the same thing. That was the days when they would either be running their businesses or would be down at the market buying the things they needed. But they would go out of their way to make sure they had special clothes set aside for these days. They were usually old clothes. They had rips and tears in them. You know, in the Old Testament, we would sometimes read about people in great anguish would rip their clothes out of their anguish. And so they would wear these clothes that already had the tears already made into them. They were older clothes. They wouldn't comb their hair that day or their beards. They would maybe even take ashes from their fires and rub it on their cheeks or their forehead, which were supposed to be signs of great mourning. And yet then they would go out and do their business that way. They wanted everybody to see them looking like they were fasting and all these things that was associated with it. And Barclay says this was no act of humility. It was a deliberate act of spiritual pride and ostentation. They found a way to take even that which should show great humility and make it a sign of great pride instead. Because they were proud of how humble they were. And the truth of the matter is, they weren't humble. But now, why would they even want to fast in the first place? What was the point of fasting? Fasting throughout the Old Testament emphasized either or both repentance and mourning. When someone died, people often fasted just out of that sense of personal loss. When people realized that they were out of a right relationship with God, they would mourn and fast and pray for forgiveness from God. And so fasting generally was associated with times of mourning and or times of penitence. It said, I am focused on a right relationship with God rather than a normal relationship in my daily life, like eating and drinking. And it was also sort of saying, I would rather have the great blessing from God of having a right relationship with Him even more than enjoying the daily blessings from God of the bread and drink He gives me every day. And so it had a right intent. And yet, when it came to be something that people just did for show, the entire meaning of it and the value of it was lost. And that seemed to be the case in Jesus' day. And so Jesus says, again, we read it, when you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show men they are fasting. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. You see, when people fasted because they truly were mourning, or fasted because they were truly penitent, what reward were they seeking? Comfort and forgiveness. But when they fasted to be seen of men, what reward were they looking for? The praise and honor of men. And that's what they got. And nothing more from God. And so that's what Jesus is telling those who would follow Him. That's what He's telling us. And even though we may not practice fasting very much, if at all in some cases, He is telling us if we do fast, and there is no commanded time of fasting in the Christian economy, that we're absolutely required to do that. But if we do, and when we do, we need to make sure we're doing it to be seen of God, not of men. Jesus even goes on to say, in effect, that men should not even be able to tell that we're fasting. We talked last week how some even want to make sure others know they're doing something, even when they're trying to be humble about it. They'll say, oh yeah, I've been praying for the last 3 hours about this. Jesus says they shouldn't even know. Or some will say, yeah, I've been fasting for 3 days to understand what God's will is in this matter. They shouldn't even know. That's the whole point Jesus is making. If we in any sense do it to please men or to receive praise from men, we've lost the reward that comes from God. And so He says, but when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face. In other words, do like you do every other day of the week, so that it will not be obvious to men that you're fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. God knows what our heart is. He knows if we're really broken because of our sin. He knows if we're really mourning because of the loss of a loved one or the loss of something else in our life. But that needs to be between us and God. It's not something for men to know. And if we're struggling because of failures in our life, sin in our life, and we're seeking a right or closer relationship with God and using fasting as a part of seeking that, again, that's only for God to know, not for others. That's why Jesus moves on in the next couple of verses to say something that seems like He's changing the subject, but He isn't. For He says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." We'll be talking about this a lot more next week, Lord willing. But what He's telling these people right then is that when they give, they pray, they fast to be seen of men and get the glory and honor that comes out of that, and they're filled with this pride that they look so holy, where's their treasure? What do they value? They're valuing things here on earth, aren't they? They're valuing what men think about them. They're valuing position and honor and that sort of thing. That's where their treasure is. That's what they consider valuable to them. And so that's where their heart is. But for those who truly give and pray and fast out of devotion and service and love of God, that's where their treasure is. And so that's where their heart is. That's why Jesus moves from talking about how they're doing these things publicly to be seen of men to talking about where a person's treasure is. So what are the lessons for us? Number one, I think, fasting is an important yet personal spiritual discipline. And while we have no specific commands in the New Testament of specific times and places and events in which to do it, we often see people in the rest of the New Testament in fact doing it because of the value of it in a relationship with God. In fact, if we think for a moment, we recognize Old and New Testament, how so many fasted. Some of the ones I wrote down that I could remember was Moses and Samuel, Hannah when she's praying about having a child that turned out to be Samuel, David himself, Elijah the prophet, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Daniel. In the New Testament, Jesus fasted. He only began His ministry with 40 days of it. Along with His disciples, they fasted at times. John the Baptist and his disciples also fasted. Paul fasted. They saw the value of this particular spiritual discipline. But they did not do it to be seen of men. They did it because it spoke of the intensity and determination and priority that they had in their hearts to either be right with God or to begin a new ministry, a new service for God, that they thought could only best be addressed by fasting. You know, before Jesus began His ministry, He fasted for 40 days. Before He appointed His disciples, He spent all night in prayer. When the church up in Antioch was ready to, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, to send out their very first missionaries, it says the whole church fasted along with the seven men who were sort of the leaders in the church. And then they appointed Saul and Barnabas to go out to preach the gospel to the Gentiles. So number one, fasting is an important spiritual discipline, but only if it's practiced for the right reasons and in the right way. Secondly, for me at least, I see that God is not impressed the way men may be about what we do, because God looks at the heart, while men just look at the outer action. Number three, we serve, love, and do good works for the long haul, not just when people are looking at us. If we're truly committed to God, helping the needy, praying to God, fasting, any other thing we do as a part of the spiritual disciplines that make up the Christian life, We're committed to doing that for a lifetime, not just at those times and in those places where other people can see us doing them. That's the only thing that would really please God. For after all, God sees what is in secret, and then He rewards us. Then I have to ask, what do I really treasure? Is the attention of other people and what other people think about me and what I'm doing, is that what's more important to me? Or is what God thinks? That's why it says there in Colossians chapter 3, as Paul is writing to those Christians, trying to make sure that their attention is on the right things. For he said in Colossians 3:1, "Since then you have been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things." Some in Jesus' day had their minds set on earthly things, even though they were practicing spiritual disciplines. Not so for the follower of the Lord Jesus Christ.